Now that's Leonard Bernstein, and for all you cats and dudes and dudettes who think that classical music is sleepy time music, I got another thing for you here. Are you with me, Jerry?
I'm still here.
See, a lot of people are blurry when it comes to differentiating different styles of music, and people think, oh, I only like rock and roll, or I only like country. Or in this case, if you say, I only like jazz, well, you're missing something here.
Well, I mean, that's the thing that I've spent most of my creative life over the last 25 years in the arena of classical music. And you see, I'm one of those people, and I'm not alone in the so-called classical music world in this opinion. You see, music is music, and unfortunately, the way classical. See, I don't even like that term classical because it's not.
It sounds old, doesn't it? It sounds like it's 500 years old.
It's an invention of the 20th century, that term.
And what did people call classical music back in the 1800s? What was it called?
They called it music. They called it music. You know, I don't know of a single composer in the last 500 years who wrote his music to be appreciated only by a select few. Beethoven was writing his music for people. Mozart was writing his music for people. Leonard Bernstein was writing his music for people. The Beatles wrote their music for people. I think that the term classical music is perhaps a misnomer, because that term has become a term that is applied to music that is of another time and another place. Okay? And I defy anybody with a heart, anybody with a brain, anybody with a soul to listen to any kind of music and not respond to what's there.
Well, some people just don't like country.
Well, some people don't like country. Some people don't like rock and roll. Some people don't like symphonic music. That doesn't mean it's bad. All it means is that people's tastes are different.
What about Marilyn Manson? That's pretty bad.
And people's sensibilities are different, but that doesn't mean that anything is inferior to another.
Well, tell me something, Jerry. You're a very accomplished musician. You're going to be singing with the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra
right.
This weekend, but what do you listen to when you're at home, you're doing the dishes, or you're chilling with your lady, or whatever you're doing when you're in the crib? What is it that you got on your turntable?
Well, I listen to lots of different things. I mean, because I am easily 70% of what I do is classical music. I sing at the Metropolitan Opera. I sing in all the great opera houses of the world. I sing with all the great symphonies. I think that anybody who is an accomplished musician, anybody that is really serious about what he does, and what I mean by serious is anybody who seeks to reach people, listens to everything. I mean, when I'm home, I listen to a lot of classical music. I listen to a lot of jazz. I listen to a lot of big band music. I listen to a lot of rock and roll. Just after Lenny died in 1991, I had the opportunity to do a piece that Paul McCartney wrote. I did the world premiere of a piece called the Liverpool Oratorio. And I spent about 8 months working very closely with Paul McCartney, who, you know, in his own way, is as great a cultural icon as Leonard Bernstein was. And here's a guy who we associate with, solely with rock and roll music, who I had conversations with over tea, over beers, who said...
Probably not over any hamburgers, though.
Pardon me?
You probably didn't have any conversations with him over any beef.
No, that's true, because he's a veggie. He's a veggie. But, I mean, here's a guy that says, Igor Stravinsky, man, that guy knew how to write music. Mozart, he knew how to write music. You see, I think that we're living in an age where our focus is so narrow in many ways that our fear of being ignorant about this or that or the other thing prevents us from just experiencing what music has to say. Now, you know, I said earlier that I worked very closely with Lenny off and on for 11 years, and, you know, I never heard Leonard Bernstein say anything negative or derogatory about any kind of music. He was as familiar with rap music as he was with classical music.
Really? Rap music?
Oh, yeah.
And was he down with Dr. Dre?
Yeah. I mean, he knew who those people were. The thing that I think is really interesting about Leonard Bernstein, and the thing that for me was so life-changing in many ways, is that he confirmed my instincts.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is that my instincts are that all music comes from the same place. The only thing that separates a rap song from a Mahler symphony is style. That's the only thing that's different. That's the only thing that's different.
And style, of course, is indicative of tastes and cultural upbringing.
What I mean is that the way that one expresses oneself when one is writing for a symphony orchestra is different than one is writing a rap song. But, you know, human beings all experience love, hate, jealousy, envy, exultation, joy, and that comes through the music, anger. Whether it is expressed symphonically or whether it is expressed in a pop song, one of my favorite songs of all time is a song that Irving Berlin wrote in, I don't know, 1915 or so, called What'll I Do? I think that we're too hung up on the labels today.
Oh, I agree.
And we're not giving enough attention to the content, to the substance of the music we listen to.
Well, let me ask you a question, Jerry. Yeah. Jerry Hadley is going to be performing with the Cincinnati Symphony this week in an all Bernstein concert.
Right.
And you're doing the overture to Candide.
Well, I'm not doing the overture to Candide.
Well, the Cincinnati Symphony is.
Kobosch is doing it. I'm only doing West Side Story.
But on the program includes the overture to Candide, the Chichester Psalms, and the symphonic music from West Side Story, and the dances. Do you think a more interesting program might be a couple of Bernstein numbers, and then maybe The Last Poets, and then maybe a local rock and roll band, and then maybe somebody who could come up and pick the hell out of a banjo?
Well, I think there's a lot to be said for that. When you're dealing with Leonard Bernstein, however, I mean, you cover the whole waterfront, because you have to understand that here's a man who wrote West Side Story, who wrote On the Town, who wrote Candide, but who also was singularly responsible for resuscitating, in our time, the music of two largely forgotten, quote-unquote, classical composers.
Let me guess, one of them is Mahler.
One of them is Gustav Mahler, and the other one is Carl Nielsen.
Now, what role did Bernstein have with Carl Nielsen? I know a little bit about Carl Nielsen's music. He was a conductor in the late 1800s and early 1900s.
That's right, and he was Scandinavian.
Yeah, he wrote music in Norway or someplace,
didn't
he?
That's right, he was Norwegian. Well, the thing was that Lenny was a champion of both of those composers, and Mahler, until Lenny, as the musical director of the New York Philharmonic, began to program Mahler. Mahler had been largely forgotten for a lot of
reasons. This was in the early 50s, right?
Yeah, for lots of reasons. I mean, Mahler was a Jew. Mahler fell out of favor in Europe during the Nazi time.
Well, of course.
And he had been largely relegated to the dustbin of history. And Lenny resuscitated him and was singularly responsible for repopularizing the music of Gustav Mahler.
Well, if nobody was performing Mahler's works, how did Leonard find out about him in the first place?
Well, I mean, everybody who was a quote-unquote classical musician knew about Gustav Mahler. I mean, you know, this is not a particularly singular occurrence, because for 100 years after Johann Sebastian Bach died, his music was largely forgotten.
Right, and Mendelssohn brought it back, didn't he?
That's right, and Mendelssohn brought Bach's music back to the public consciousness.
Well, Jerry, do you think there's anybody composing music today that's going to be forgotten for 50 or 100 years, and the Leonard Bernstein of the year 2070 is going to bring something back?
I don't know. That's hard to say, because unfortunately, today we're living in an age where the people who are the arbiters of taste and the people that are the people who decide what gets programmed, either on a radio station or on a symphony concert or in an opera house, people are playing it very safe these days in most cases. And money has become the primary motivator, so people go with things that they know are sure winners.
I'll tell you something. A lot of these radio stations in this town and across the country have a thing called consulting firms. And then you give a little bit of money to these consulting firms, and they give you a surefire playlist that's sure to increase your revenue and your ratings.
Well, that's right. And, you know, I understand that, and I think that...
And, you know, even our classical music stations do that. The one here in town, it's a little further up the dial. You're only going to hear the top 100 Beethoven and Mozart pieces on that station.
Well, yeah, I mean, because they're going with the things that they know are sure winners. And I think that on the one hand, there's nothing wrong with that because it's all great music. But on the other hand, I think that attitude denies... Well, I think that the assumption that is made with that kind of an attitude is that the public is stupid. And I have to tell you, I've been singing on the stage for 25 years, and I have never in my life ever sung for a stupid audience. I've sung in lots of small towns and small cities in America and also in Europe. And even if people don't know the piece that you're singing or performing, people respond to honesty and people respond to directness when you perform. And it doesn't matter what we're presenting if we present it honestly. You see, as a classical music performer, I think that we have done a tremendous disservice to our public in the last 20 years or so by going on stage and lecturing to them too often. I don't think people pay $100 for a seat at the Metropolitan Opera to be lectured to. I think people need to be entertained. And I suppose that's maybe not a popular thing to say, because we have developed this attitude in not only in this country, but in Europe, in the world at large, that classical music is somehow a sacred cow that needs to be treated with deference and needs to be treated with kid gloves. Let me give you an example. When George Gershwin wrote Porgy and Bess in the 30s, he couldn't get it performed in an opera house.
It was too pop, right?
So it was performed on Broadway. Well, now, you know, some 50 years after his death, it was performed in the 80s on the stage of the Metropolitan Opera, finally. I think that we've become so mired in judgment that we have disallowed ourselves our humanity in many ways, because you know, perhaps from a programming standpoint, if you program a Beethoven symphony in the first half of a program and then do Led Zeppelin in the second half, perhaps that's not a really good marriage just in terms of continuity. But it doesn't. But the human soul exists in both of those.
Exactly. Let me throw a crazy idea at you, Jerry.
All right.
At the next, you know, Cincinnati Symphony concert, let's say we're all going down to Music Hall to catch the show. At the next show, why don't they take out all the seats? Put the seats back in a back room somewhere. You don't want to throw them away, but put them away back in the back so everyone has to stand during the concert. And then let's dim the lights, but not all the way, just a little bit, all right? And then let's take the bar that's normally out in the foyer. Let's put the bar, like, back in the back of the concert hall. And let's let the people mingle and maybe even chatter a little bit while the music is going on.
That's not a new idea.
Well, why hasn't it been done in the 20th century?
If you read accounts of performances in the 18th century and the 19th century, that was often the case. I think that what's happened...
Hey, my producer here says old people can't stand up that long. We need to get more young people going to the symphony, or at least you performers who are making your living at it and who are hoping to get by and put bread on the table by performing this kind of music. Don't you think you need to get some of the younger folk in there so that in 20 years, when all the blue hairs are under the ground, you might still have an audience?
Well, I think, yes, I think that's true. I think that, however, there is some music that requires, because it's much more complex, because it's much more dense, it requires a certain kind of attention to be paid to it that other music doesn't require.
Why? Because there's a little more going on than bunch of crunchy guitar riffs?
I'm not saying that it's better or worse. I'm saying that if you go and you sit through a Mahler symphony, you got to pay attention. You have to participate as an audience member.
But sometimes, I listen to that music, and sometimes when you drop in somewhere in the middle, you can be pleasantly surprised.
Oh, absolutely. But all I'm saying is I think that the concert-going environment has developed that way for a lot of reasons. One of the big problems I think we have in this country, well, not just in this country, but in pretty much all the industrial democracies, is that our educational system has become, we no longer contemplate anything. We've become a reactive society, and when we go to school,
read your books and take the test.
We read the books, we take the tests, and we take the tests for very pragmatic reasons, so that we can get a job, so that we can make a living.
But not necessarily because we really care about the exploits of Magellan.
That's right. And I think that somewhere there ought to be a balance that we can strike, because we wouldn't have been given brains and souls and hearts if we were not expected by our Creator to think, to contemplate, to sit still and listen and absorb. You know, the thing that I always find amazing about music is that you can get 20 people and put them in a room and play a recording of, you name it, whatever, and you'll have 20 different responses to it, and that's what it should be. That's what it should be. There is no right and there is no wrong response to any piece of music. I think that the thing that is wrong is when we go on stage and say, this is what you have to get out of this. This is what I want you to believe. I think that our duty as performers is to make a decision about how we individually feel about what we're performing, and simply present that with no other agenda. And if one person in the audience gets one thing and another person in the audience gets another thing, that's fine. But I believe, and what I try to do when I go on stage, is not to bring my own biases to the music. I bring my point of view to the music, but I try to just let myself be the vessel through which the music says whatever it says to whomever says it. It requires each one of us being committed to the music. But it also requires us, in a kind of a strange way, stepping back from the music and just letting the music happen.
Check this out, Jerry. I'm looking a little ahead of the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra's schedule for this upcoming season. And God, they're doing a lot of Tchaikovsky and Beethoven. Mm-hmm. Way too much. However, on the weekend of November 7th, they're doing a program that includes the Passacaglia by Webern, a piano concerto by Saint-Saëns, three pieces for orchestra by Berg. All right, and then the 2001 music by Strauss.
Yeah.
All right. Now there's a little bit of a mixed up program for you. It's a little schizophrenic. If we could get the kids to go to that one, the Berg is going to turn them on, and it's not real long either.
We're not going to get the kids to go to these concerts by telling them that they're going to go. And
what about strobe lights?
Well, I think if you can find a piece where strobe lights.
Yeah, I'm not kidding. Strobe lights are cool.
I'm not kidding, and I'm not disagreeing with you.
And if they're going to do the Strauss 2001 music, it's called Also Sprach Zarathustra.
Right, and we all in our generation have a connotation based upon 2001 A Space.
Spaceships. So if they could get some spaceships in there for that one, or at least put one of the Apollo landers out in the foyer, that might be cool.
Well, I think that I'm on the same page with you.
Yeah.
With this, because I think that there is a commonality, and there is a way. See, I'm going to get back to Leonard Bernstein, okay?
Well, hold on a second, Jerry.
What?
Hold on a second. Talking about music is like reading about dancing, and I want to get a little music in here. If you'll give me 7 minutes, I want to throw a little music at you, and then we'll come back and wrap it up a little bit.
You got 7 minutes, and then I'll continue to pontificate, okay?
I got a little bit of a... It's not the most rare record in the world, but I've got this hard-to-find LP, Benny Goodman playing some different pieces, and he's doing Leonard Bernstein's Prelude, Fugue, and Riffs.
Oh, great.
For clarinet and band. Have you ever heard it?
Yeah, I have.
This thing will... If you've never heard it, this thing's going to turn you on. So, kids, pucker up here. You're going to like this one.
Thank you.
Benny Goodman there on the Licorice Stick, performing Leonard Bernstein's Prelude, Fugue, and Riffs, along with the, I don't know what the name of the orchestra was, but it's a very cool orchestra there. We're talking to Jerry Hadley, who's going to be performing with the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra this weekend in an all-Leonard Bernstein program, including Candide, Chichester Psalms, and the Symphonic, and dances from West Side Story. Jerry,
yep.
What do you think of that clarinet piece there?
Well, I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? I mean, you know, to the casual music listener, you don't expect Leonard Bernstein and Benny Goodman to be a particularly good marriage, but there you have it.
Well, why not? If he's got that West Side Story music is absolutely swinging, why wouldn't you expect Benny Goodman to swing?
Well, Mozart swings too. So does Beethoven. So do all people that
write.
Well, you got
to be careful, because when you start jazzing up the classics, a lot of time you can get a lot of musical crap.
Well, yeah, but see, I think that the thing is that you have to approach every musical style for what that musical style is. You know what I mean? And I think that the problem that we have often is that we try to judge a particular musical style based upon the same criteria that we judge another musical style. You can't judge Beethoven with the same criteria that you judge whether a jazz piece is good or not, because so-called classical music, symphonic music, is a very structured, very exacting way of performing music, whereas jazz is based in improvisation. But you know, all of those guys that have come down in history as great classical composers were also wonderful improvisers. And a lot of those symphonies, you know, like the Fifth Symphony of Beethoven, all of the great symphonies, were the result of those guys sitting down at a piano and improvising.
Jamming.
And coming up with an idea.
Can you imagine hanging out at a jam session with Haydn and Beethoven?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, if you want to talk about Leonard Bernstein and jazz, I can remember countless times after rehearsals or after performances where we go up to Lenny's suite or go to his apartment in New York, and Lenny would sit down at the piano and improvise at the keyboard jazz. He was a big Elvis fan. He was a big Beatles fan. He knew his frame of reference about music was practically limitless. And I think that if people could just get over their hang-ups about the labels that we put on music, just listen, just absorb, just, you know, listen, respond as a person.
Jerry, have you ever heard The Rite of Spring by Igor Stravinsky?
Absolutely.
It's a very neat piece. It's got a lot of drumming in it, a lot of percussion, and it's really upbeat. Now, I've heard it performed and conducted in ways that were very classically oriented and sort of boring. And I've also seen a videotape of Leonard Bernstein conducting it, in which he was jumping up and down, really getting into it, and that inspired the performance to really swing it.
That's right.
And that's a classical music type piece.
See, the other thing is, I don't think you can judge any piece of music based upon one performance, because a performance is only as good or as exciting as the excitement and the risk-taking that the people performing it inject into it. And, you know, it's a very inexact thing, music. And, you know, you can have the same person performing a piece of music on five successive days, and it's going to be a different piece of music each day. Because as human beings, you know, we change. You know, Lenny, I remember Lenny saying, you know, if he had a crappy dinner, he'd go on the podium and his performance would be affected by what he had to eat or.
Well, shouldn't a professional be able to rise above all that?
Well, yeah, I think in one way he should, and I think Lenny did, and I think all of us who are professional musicians have a certain standard that we approach every time.
But in order to rise above all that, you also have to perform from the heart.
Well, yeah, but there are lots of variables. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of variables.
So if somebody buys a ticket to this weekend's performance, it's Friday and Saturday night at 8 o'clock at the Music Hall downtown. Sunday, what time Sunday?
Also at 8 o'clock, but I don't think it's in the Symphony Hall, and I can't remember where it is. I'm sorry, okay. I'm a moron.
We can't promote that, but either way, Friday and Saturday at Music Hall, It's a great date. I'm telling you, they got wine. All right, you can put on nice clothes. What can the listener expect to hear when he comes, when he or she comes to the performance this weekend?
I think you can expect to hear the genius of Leonard Bernstein in many facets.
Now, what about you? You're singing in it, right? You're playing. You're going to sing the part of Tony.
Right.
Can you lay a little Maria on us?
Oh.
You didn't know I was going to ask you that.
I didn't know you were going to ask. It's too late. I'm too old and I'm too tired.
And you don't want to wake up the cats in the room next door.
No, I don't want to wake up the cats in the room next door.
Are you a baritone or a tenor?
I'm a tenor.
So that would probably break the glass there in the hotel, wouldn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, they don't like it when I when I hold forth.
That's okay. You musicians are supposed to be throwing the television out the window, though, aren't you?
Why?
That's the old rock star idiom. And some of it, don't you want to be like, you know, you're crossing all the boundaries here. Wouldn't you like to be a little bit of a rock star and throw the television out the window?
If I throw the television out the window, I can't watch Spectrevision.
Jerry, how can you tell which guy in the symphony is a percussionist?
I don't know. Is this a joke?
He's the guy hanging out with all the musicians.
You're bad.
All right, thanks. We'll catch you later. I'll see you this weekend, I'm sure.
Okay.
Like I said, Jerry Hadley, he'll be singing the tenor part of Tony Friday and Saturday night, 8 o'clock at Music Hall. Tickets are cheap. Check it out.
Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome. We'll be right back in a minute. Here's a little bit of the music you're going to hear. This is from West Side Story, the Symphonic Dances, Suites number 1 and 2.